So what I want to do in our final hour is see what you need, finish up on kind of this piece of the action story. I want to do these other things because I have, certainly this slide is really interesting to me these days. I was raised agnostic, right? So I'm really working hard on, I have some meditation practice going and interested in, I fly fish. So I'm interested in spiritual practice in nature. But the reality is I'm really trying to integrate in my own practice something that was entrained out of me in graduate school, because when you go to graduate school, we are really working hard to say this is science. Scientific method, scientific inquiry, studies, research, evidence-based, empirically, right? So we have this incredible bias toward things which are of the rational, knowable mind. And it occurred to me, not for some time now, that I'm not that effective solving problems with my rational mind. That, in fact, our ability to know something is such a small percentage of our experiencing of it, that by the time you have a conscious thought, you've already had 90% experiencing, right? By the time you say, I'm mad, your body is already fully in that space. So our the tip of the iceberg thing, our ability to really solve problems just with our conscious mind applied, you know, rational cortical mind applied to problem solving, it seems very limited, doesn't it? At least for me it is, and I was raised in, you know, the most scientific of traditions, both by my family and by my training. So the thing is this, we make meanings. We are, by the time someone is 18 months old to 2 years old, language develops, we begin storying our lives. We begin telling why things happen the way they do. We begin assigning values and meanings and desires mediated by language to events. If you have horrible things happen to you or not, you tell stories about how you got here and what your purpose on earth is. We can't help ourselves. Your kid comes home late and he hasn't called. You've already, by the time he walks in the door, you've written a novel. Right? Am I correct? Do you understand where I'm going with this? So one of the things that's interesting to me in terms of moral development and spiritual connectivity, that trauma states, hyper-arousal, anxiety states are completely incompatible with contemplative spiritual meditative states. Right? It is in fact a must-pick one. You can't both be agitated and hyper-aroused and at peace. Right? And so that interests me. Why are we doing all of this scientific stuff all the time if there are other ways of connecting people to meaning and purpose and value and what am I doing here on earth and why am I here in adolescence? That's a good question. But in our whole lives, don't you think? It's still a good question. And if you have horrible things happen to you that are We ascribe meanings. It could be the meaning, I don't deserve to be happy or well, or I asked for it, or my God is a vindictive God, or I mean, I don't know. People do, right? And how do we use the very human and profoundly important meaning-making structure that people have in adolescence and in life to in the service of therapy and healing from trauma? And I'm interested in this because I feel as though that would be something that would really help my clients if I understood it better, and I did it better, and I lived it better. So there was a research study on a bunch of therapists who worked in an inpatient psychiatric setting, and this is the study. Nothing was done on the patients. The study was on the therapists. Half of the therapists were taught mindfulness meditation and developed mindfulness practices. Half weren't. You with me? Then the outcome measure is whose patients got better. And in a very dramatic way, the people who had mindfulness practice, not that they were teaching it to the inpatients, but the therapists who had mindfulness practices had patients get better at a very, very statistically significant rate, faster rate.
You mean they practice?
They practice mindfulness themselves, right. So the therapists, half of the therapists meditated and lived in the world in a more intentional, mindful, clear-headed way. The other half continued just to, you know, type while the patients were talking to them. I don't know, right? I don't know what, but anyway, they were living in the, I mean, the key thing to me, and it's this interesting study, right? The thing about this study that ties in with this is how do we bring our higher selves, our spiritual ways of being connected, okay, forget the adoring eyes, what about our sense of purpose and meaning and value and why people suffer? Why do children suffer? How come we live in a world where horrible, horrible things happen to little children? Oh, that shuts you up. You know, whether or not you believe in a higher power or you're a religious person, you are assigning meanings all the time, and so are your clients. And I'm not talking necessarily about formalized religion, but I am talking about how we incorporate justice, morality, a sense of connectivity to the world and to others and to just, and you know, into, I don't know, into living with purpose. And am I making any sense? I can't even tell. What, anybody want to? Yeah.
That feels to me, for me, in my work, I try to be really careful.
Yeah, I know, me too.
My clients often very much believe in a higher power, and in a very traditional way,
yeah.
God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to cut it for me.
Yeah.
And so, and especially when, you know, when you say, you know, how do you...
Yeah, God only gives you as much as you can handle. You mean if I couldn't handle that, this wouldn't have happened, right?
Yeah,
that
kind of. People, right,
or yeah.
And a 4-month-old handles what?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah. But let me ask you this. I'm struggling with. So I'm not refuting it, or you know, this is not a repost or something. Because this slide is, I've been doing this for a couple years with this slide. There's something exciting to me about it though. So let's say you have somebody who has a meaning-making system or doesn't, but in your case does. Do you keep it, does it stay out of the room because you're uncomfortable with it?
No, it's
tricky. But what you're saying is it's tricky because it's for you. It's like, oh man, if I go there, what I'm going to hear is crazy stuff that's really going to be hard for me to handle about what happened to this 4-month-old.
That's where I have to be really careful.
Yeah, right.
But I try,
you still bring it in.
What I'm trying to bring is a respect of mm-hmm. what's working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
This is one of the things that is,
yeah.
is
yeah.
working. And
yeah.
It doesn't matter to me if it's real or not.
Yeah, but it's part of what their meaning-making system is. Mm-hmm. And with adolescents, this is where what's hard for me is that the way we're trained in psychology graduate school anyway is that we juxtapose magical thinking with rational thinking, and so it's one or the other, and that religious beliefs are much more. I hope I'm not offending anyone. I mean, this is just what scientific training is about. I'm not defending it. That religious belief systems are much more on the magical belief. You have to suspend this belief, you know. It's a leap of faith kind of thing. That the scientific method and Western rational logical traditions, you know, decry. There's like, that's, you know, we're not going to do that. And I feel like we haven't done a very good job with our Western logical paradigms. And that I'm just throwing this out as something, you know, how we bring it in and how we enter into a conversation with clients who have a belief system and expanding on it and using it in the service of healing, or who think there's nothing out there and then they go do a wilderness program or something and they come back having, you know, communes with Mother Nature in some profound life transformative way, or doing something of purpose and value to another human being, you know, for someone. I mean, the spirit shows up in little and big ways. And the Buddhists say God's in us.
So those are all the ways that I relate to mm-hmm. that, you know, and I try to take those kinds of things
right.
that I can relate to.
That's great. That's great. And, you know, I mean, I have this on this original slide set, which is the impact of trauma on development, right? Remember this, we're still on the first 10 here, but I've woven a lot of, you'll see, I've done a good job with some of the afternoon slides here, I sure hope. But that the reason this is in here is that I think we don't talk about the impact of trauma on moral and spiritual development, on faith, on belief, on connection to meaning and purpose, without which we can't go on, especially in adolescence. So there is a way in which I'm throwing this out to you as you think about conversations with adolescents and families and how we connect up meaning-making systems, our own and theirs, and other kinds of ways of knowing and connecting to, I don't know, our smallness and our connectivity with the world of, you know, that even though trauma is so lonely and isolating, we are connected to other people through our gaze, through our humanity. That we are all more human than not. And that people who do horrible things to other people also suffer. And, you know, I mean, I was trained that the only person you could say that you really hate is Hitler when I was growing up. Everyone but Hitler suffers also. You know, I don't know, I'm still working on the Hitler thing. But what I think is really true when we're having these thoughts and conversations and connectivity, not just in an attachment way to us, but also attachment to purpose and to the world of I don't know, this big place, this meaningful place. People can sift that out for themselves. We can talk about it more later if you want to. I'm not gonna do this. Obviously there's a family impact and we've been talking about that. I wanna talk just a couple sentences here about risk and resilience. There are things we obviously know that are very well documented about the differences between very at-risk kids who don't make it and kids who are more resilient, what distinguishes them from their more vulnerable peers. What we also know is that at every level, from the cellular level on up to the great societal, you know, level in the last slide, there are protective factors. There are ways of knowing and being and experiencing that protect us and that serve in our best interest. And so although we know that horrible things can happen at every level, as we've talked about a lot of today, from the cellular level to the societal, I also want to say that it's a complicated balance and equation. And we remain hopeful because we don't know where the tipping point is. And as I pointed out earlier, small things can make a difference. It's a very interesting equation. It's a metric that's very confusing if you think about it. So somebody can have an unfathomably hard life for years and years, which is seemingly unremittingly difficult. And then they can join the youth choir. I'm making this up, you know, and suddenly through music, find hope again. I don't know. I mean, or a relationship. Or a pet, or I don't know, these things switch the balance in a resource way. Of course we know that kids who grow up, people who live in environments where there is more social capital, do better. That if you have a safe, stable, predictable, trustworthy environment and exposure to people and institutions that you can rely on, studies show, you do better. And that's definitely true, and it's also true that as a country, the U.S., since the 1960s, when social capital in terms of resources for children and supports for families and all the kind of education, achievement, and all the other ways that this stuff is measured has been decreasing in rather dramatic ways since they began measuring it. So we're looking at an environment that has a level of hostility in general to children and child development. People were talking yesterday about padded bathing suits for 3-year-old girls and You know, I mean, that we're looking at an environment that's pretty toxic to child development in a lot of ways, the pressure on everything. Anyway, that these are risk factors, certainly the lowering of social capital, but even so, we see the way in which protective factors also can spiral and move kids into places of advantage. Okay, so that's all I want to say about that. Bruce Perry talks about attunement in terms of this TLC model, and the T is translating what I call reading subtext, finding the meaning under the words, developing mindset, learning, not how can I get fewer problems, but, and this is very important to me, what can I do differently, what this kid is teaching me, to create environments in which she can, in which she can be more successful. So, for example, we have in Vermont, we have this thing called the planning room. And the way this works is a kid misbehaves and is sent to like a resource room or some designated person in the building where they have to fill out a sheet describing what they did wrong and what they're going to do differently next time. Right? Do you have that in your environment? You do this. How do they work?
They don't work.
They don't work. They don't work. And they don't seem to work because the same kids are going to plan over and over again. If they worked, then the kid would be done planning. So this is my theory about this. It hasn't been tried out. But but my theory based on the way I'm teaching you guys today and what's going on in our ownership of as adults in the lives of kids who can't do stuff. I feel like the missing step in the planning room is not just what are you going to do differently, but how could I have made you made it more successful for you? What do you think I could do to shape it so that you feel more included in my class, more successful in my class, in my relationship, in my home? How do I do this too? That both of us need to plan for the next time. And I do this with families all the time. And parents, they just want the kid to change their behavior. I'm the grown-up. So, well, no, it's not like that because if you're reactive and escalate it, the kid is going to escalate. You're the adult. You set the emotional tone in the house. If your emotional tone is reactive and escalating, then that's the emotional tone that's going to be in the house. So what you can say is, I will try not to be so reactive next time. You need to practice not, you know, nagging me after I say no, or whatever the thing is. And I will not keep talking to you after I say no, because that escalates us. And, you know, this is stressful for adults. And I do this in therapy all the time. This was a hard hour. What could I have done differently to make this better? What's our job? If you're struggling or a child is struggling, whose job is it to help them stop struggling? Do this better next time. That's what we say. Study harder. I don't know. Okay, you get my idea. And then control is not about controlling them because they're about controlling you. It's about controlling yourself, your emotions, setting the emotional tone. So I want to practice something. You have a couple slides here that are about subtext, some things, it's not the kids say this, but these are some of my ideas about why trauma brains are reactive brains and what's happening underneath when a kid hurts themselves or other people, what's going on underneath. And I'm not going to do all these, but I want to just practice with you guys about reading subtext. So I'm really interested in this. So a kid says, and this is sort of the what we were talking about earlier about setting, you know, sort of therapeutically changing the tone. So a kid says, leave me alone. What could they also be meaning?
I need space.
I
need
space.
It hurts.
It hurts.
I'm upset.
I'm upset.
You're
going
to leave anyway.
You might as well split now.
Everybody else is screwed.
Everybody else is screwed up with me.
Has
screwed up with me, so, you know, don't even try. Don't even bother. Excellent, yeah.
When testing, like, come
on. Will you leave me alone? Please don't leave me alone. And there's no right answer here, obviously. But do you see how your awareness of possibility shapes what you would do next? Because if you actually think what's happening is a fear, you could say, you know, I bet you might sometimes feel afraid that I'm going to leave you, but I'm not. I'm just staying here, and I'll be back next week, or I'm just right outside the door. I'm going to come back in 5 minutes and try again, or, you know, I don't know, if that's your explanation. If your explanation is everyone else has left me, you might say, you know, I can see why you would be hesitant to let me hang in here with you, given your story of disappointment. A lot of people have disappointed you and have left you alone. And the kid can say, no, shut up. It's their right. But you've named it and tried to respond differently. I think we get a lot of points for guessing and for doing this kind of therapeutic subtext responding. If we respond to text with these kids, we will go insane. I really believe that. And I say this to parents all the time. If you listen to what those words are saying, you will lose your mind. And it's not right. I mean, the leave me alone thing is particularly poignant to me, even with typical kids, because parents actually think that's what kids mean when they say that. Yeah.
In school, the kid will say, I don't care, and the teachers will assume that they don't care.
Yeah, I don't care.
I don't know the kid that
well, let's try that.
To do well.
Let's try that. I don't care. What else could that mean? I don't understand what you're asking me to do.
I'm a failure.
I'm not going to let this matter to me because I've had too many disappointments.
It's easier for me to say I don't care.
It's easier to disengage and say I don't care because caring is, you know, you guys won't even look at each other for crap.
I got to be strong.
I can't show vulnerability.
I have to not care before you don't care.
Yeah, right. You can't fire me, I quit. Yeah, okay. Do you see how cool this is? And you see how hard it is to get teachers and parents to do this. And this is the reacting,
so
responding. Right, I know, and you're off to the races.
So
the genius with these kids is like, we are such little push button Bobo dolls for these kids. You know, it's like, press the I don't care button and we're off to the races, or, you know, right, or F you, and then, you know, you're in a hole. I've had this in family therapy sessions with these families where, We're doing something really interesting and productive and meaningful, and the kid mumbles some stupid thing under his breath, you know. And then all of a sudden, we're in some Twilight Zone episode of like, you can't swear, don't swear. And I'm like, what happened to this really productive, interesting conversation we were just having? We were completely derailed. And the kid's a genius. Right? It's a genius. The kid didn't want to be having this intimate conversation. This he knows about.
Yeah, exactly.
This is home.
Exactly.
Yeah. This I'm familiar with. Okay, you get the idea. So I work with families in vivo to do this and in training environments like this to help therapists stay in the responding versus reacting brain. Every time you listen to content and text with your wise brain and take an inhale and an exhale, you can say, tell me more about that. Sounds like this is going to be too hard for you right now. I mean, you just go some other really cool place that's empathic. It's not like they get to get out of demands all the time. But you can still be empathic and say, yeah, it sounds like this is really hard for you, and I'll help you do it because you're going to have to do it. Both is true.
I was supervising who did this in perfectly a good way.
Uh-huh.
She came to my office in tears. I said, what happened? I said, well, you know, whatever you just said. The kid snapped his head up and said, where'd you learn that, psych 101?
Bingo!
Yes.
Yeah, my kids say to me when I do this, they say, don't do this on your own, kids.
Right.
Right. Don't practice it, you know. But it's right. Oh, it's okay.
It was great. It wasn't great for them, but it was great.
I've had teenagers say to me, don't use that therapy voice.
Yeah.
Say, oh, wow, that's centrally hard. Oh, don't use that therapy voice. And like, you know, actually, I'm feeling kind of, ugh, don't use the therapy voice. So we know these things don't work really that well. It's a big list, isn't it? But, you know, really seriously, the genius of this kind of list, and this is not a definitive list of what doesn't work, right? But, I mean, I've said this to you a few times today. People want to keep doing this. This is kind of a hubris thing, you know? That, what is that sign of that mental illness thing? You keep doing the same thing, expecting a different outcome. And I would say that this list, it's maybe not definitive, But we all know many examples of times we and other people that we work with and know, working with trauma kids. Do it, or you reason them out of it. Like, the factual thing, I mean, I'm saying to teachers, just give, or parents, just let it go, you know? I'm working with a family, and the mother just wants this kid to be accountable in some, like, just minute way. I'm like, just, you know what? You're right. You're absolutely right. And now we have to let it go. Because being right in this situation, what's it going to, what are you going to do with this? How is it going to serve you in the future in remaining connected and knowing of your child? So sometimes being right, just, oh, what is it with us? And, well, this has to work. This is what we do. We're a behavioral environment, or this is what I, you know, my kid has to behave this way because that's what we do, you know, or whatever it is. Like, you know, okay. The other thing is I hand the white flag pretty fast with some of these situations where I say, look, I have a PhD. I've been doing this for a lot of years. I know some things. I don't know everything. It really might not help. You're right. I could really screw it up. I could really disappoint you and let you down. I really might not understand how unbelievably difficult and nightmarishly stressed and terrified you are. And I think we should give this a try, because power struggles await. And so if what I'm suggesting doesn't make things feel better in your house, you can go back to having power struggles. You already know how to do that. You don't need me for that. I can't help you with that. In fact, I refuse to help you with that. Because I think your kid's brain is too hot. And in order for it to heal, it needs to cool down. And every time you get into a hot issue, it hurts your brain, it hurts her brain, it hurts your relationship. It's not working, that's why you're here. You know, you don't have to believe me about this. You can think that I am from Brattleboro. And, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, people do. They think, well, you know, you're some kind of, I don't know. Right? Other. There's an otherness to this approach. I say to people, there is 0% in hyper-punitive, hitting kids. I mean, I don't believe in any of that. I'm not even American, I think. You know, most Americans think you should hit your kids. I've read a lot of the research. There's not a shred of data to support. Whatever. I mean, what I love is the best is hitting your kid saying this, no hitting. Okay. So I have here, and we've been doing a lot of these interventions all day long. So I'm not that worried here. It's now about 3:20, and we have about 45 minutes. So I'm curious, either from this list or from the day, what you guys want to talk about, where you want to go. Yeah.
Affect interventions. Particularly tolerance. I mean, I could do the whole DBT thing. I know about DBT. I'm interested to hear from you about affect modulation and tolerating.
Okay, let's do that. What else do people want to do? It doesn't even have to be off this list. I wanna digress briefly too. So
yeah, concurrent, coherent identity.
Do more narrative stuff, yeah. Identity narrative stuff. Okay, you did that with me yesterday a little bit too. You want to do it again? Okay. Yeah.
Number 5, resiliency.
Okay. Let's do some of that. I have two little digressions that are related. As we'll tie back in. D.W. Winnicott wrote a monograph in the 1950s called The Hope and the Antisocial Tendency. And he was writing about juvenile delinquents acting out kids. And his thesis was this. Kids who have some taste of early holding and attachment and attunement, who later act out, are actually hopeful. And what they're hoping for is that, well, someone will come hold them again and contain them again and find them. And that kids who never had that are much less likely to act out in that way where they're looking behind them to see if anyone is there. Does this make sense? So that a lot of our really dysregulated kids that were dealing with issues of holding and containment are, I have my seminal text on this subject is this book called The Runaway Bunny. Are people familiar with this book? Mm-hmm. A seminal text. So this is a book for two-year-olds that I think is the best attachment trauma adolescent book that exists, actually, not to necessarily read it with them, for us to understand it as a reenactment of a two-year-old drama that is developmentally normative for two-year-olds who are sowing, you know, their little identity oats. And so the runaway bunny says to his mom that he's running away. I'm out of here. He says, I'm running away. If you run away, says his mother, I will run after you, for you are my little bunny. Okay, so the setup here, gorgeous, right? We got the oppositional defiant kid, I'm out of here, you're not the boss of me. And the mother who says, you belong to me, I'm coming to get you, right? Okay, so he switches forms. He says, I'm not going to do this whole thing, I promise, but if you run after me, I will become a fish in a trout stream and I will swim away from you. Mother says, if you become a fish in a trout stream, I will become a fisherman and I will fish for you. You with me? Isn't this fabulous? So by the end, he tries to do all these things. And he says, I will become a little boy and run into a house. He's out of resources at the end. You know, he's caving after he's been a mountain and a river. And she says, if you become a little boy and run into a house, said the mother bunny, I will become your mother and catch you in my arms and hug you. And there she is doing that. And there he says, shucks, said the little bunny, I might just as well stay where I am and be your little bunny. And so he did. Have a carrot, said the mother bunny. Is that great? Okay, do people know this book? The thing I love about this is, well, so much, right? You'll get it. I don't need to interpret it. But, you know, when we're trying to come up with forms and understanding what it is I'm trying to teach you about holding and attachment and attunement and trying again, all this stuff, this is the text here. I mean, have you ever had this experience where you, this happened to me, I know it was a shocking thing, and an adolescent in a family session swore and ran out of the room? Has that ever happened to anyone but me?
No.
Am I the only one that's ever happened to? And split, you know, like gone. And so her parents are sitting on the couch like yogurt, like this, you know, and I'm like, go get her. And dad's like, it's Brattleboro. It's enough. We're almost done. I said, no, go get her. You can't just let her go away like that. You got to go get her. And they're like, gee, the third floor walk up. I told you that, right? I mean, it's like, And then you hear her coming, stomping furious up the stairs like 10 minutes later. And next to my office, incidentally, is a yoga studio. And they are not, they're doing their ohms. And I have this swearing teenager. I get in trouble in the building. Like, I say to them, I'm not baking cookies in there, you know. That's what I tell them. And they come in and complain. What do you want me to do? I'm doing the best I can. So anyway, the kid comes back up and she's like that. And I ask the parents to leave after a couple minutes. And I say, you know, that was awesome. I am so proud of you for coming back because that was really hard to do. And I'm really glad you did. And she said, you made them, didn't you? And I said, well, we collaborated. It was collaborative. She knew, right? But she also knew this was the drama. And, you know, Winnicott talked about it. I experience it all the time with, you know, these oppositional push away. If you read the text, you know, go away, leave me alone. How do we do this with 16-year-olds that are so wounded? This is a brilliant mother bunny, replete with giving the snack, right?
So can I ask a question about that? Mm-hmm. I have a new client that is a 16-year-old boy, 280 pounds, you know, twice my size, mm-hmm. 6'4", in and out of jail.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I was a little frightened
yeah.
of him.
Yeah.
So
when, and we had a good first meeting, mm-hmm. but the second mm-hmm. meeting, he said, I don't want to ever see you again. Mm-hmm. And I really tried to summon
your mother bunny self.
Right, and to hear the subtext and to offer other alternatives. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, we don't have to talk. Let's play cards. Mm-hmm, let's cook. He liked to cook. Blah, blah, blah.
Awesome.
All of it mm-hmm. was rejected. And I did say, can we make another appointment at least? And in the time, you could think about it. If you don't want to meet, we won't meet, you know? And he said, no, there's no sense in that. Mm-hmm. Now, part of me feels like I said, okay.
Yeah.
And I think the okay came from my
brain. Yeah, like, okay, good, goodbye. What's your hindsight? Does your hindsight say maybe I should have said, here's your next appointment, I'll see you? Is this going to be hard work?
I guess that's my question. Yeah. Is at what point, if you're giving a kid choices to say, you know, it really is up to you. You can be here or not be here. If that is really going to be a choice. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a question, too. I don't know. I mean, it's so easy to Monday morning quarterback this stuff. It's, you know, and plus you're describing very honestly your ambivalence, too. So it's a tough. The choice question with kids who are traumatized in attachment disorder, the common wisdom is don't give them choices. Or tell them what's going to happen. Or if there's a choice, it's a forced choice. You can come at 2 or at 4 next week. But you come. So, I mean, that's the wisdom on the street generically. In the specific, his runaway bunny behavior was landing him in jail, and that was his mama bunny was the jail. And your intimacy was maybe more than he could tolerate. So that's a reality, too. I have a graduate student, I know if this is a similar thing, who had a really good early session with a girl who she came in and we played the tape and they laughed and they cried. She said, this is the best session I've ever had. It's incredible, Marty. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry. I'm a bad supervisor and I haven't done well by you. And she said, you're not listening to me. I had a great session. And I said, no, I needed to tell you something that I failed to tell you, which is it can't get too good. It can't be too comfortable, too happy, too intimate. She has no internal working model for relationship that involves intimacy that feels good. And with a, you know, attractive young woman, I mean, he's out of his gourd, right? So he's feeling close to this, you know, mother, girlfriend, whatever, I don't know who you are to him, you know, nice person, offering to connect with, I don't know. Like, your first session was maybe too good. I mean, it's terrible to say because, okay, so let me summarize. It can't be too bad, it can't be too good, right? So I know I'm giving you kind of confusing feedback on this. But one of the places I come from is in terms of asking for feedback in that first session, it's possible it still might have all sifted out exactly as it did, okay? I mean, no crystal ball here. It's possible that you can, we were talking about this with no-shows and stuff, that when we are creating the context for the therapy, that if it isn't a context that feels meaningful and sane and safe to an adolescent who has only had scary contexts that bad things happen and then he gets contained in a punitive way, you're offering him something that is Martian-like. And so what you were unable to do, and I'm not saying you could have or I could have or anything, I hope you're not hearing anything corrective from me in this because I'm just guessing, but if you are trying to create the context for change in an early session or two and what you did was start therapy that felt connective and good instead of really workman-like, you know, creating. What do you think therapy is? What do you expect therapy to be? Who am I supposed to be in your mind? What's your experience? You know, all those kind of workman-like contextual questions so that you can get to the place in his meaning-making system for what he thinks you are or would be or going to, you know, in this kind of safe, almost detached, but informationally connective way, it's possible that he would come back the second time and feel empowered enough to be there. I don't know, I'm asking, I don't know. It's a wild guess. I'm gonna keep going. Yeah?
What about, you've talked a lot about acting out adolescents, but what about the overly compliant adolescents?
Yeah, yeah, the real inhibited attachment kids who are really, you see many of them?
I have one.
Yeah, yeah, these kids who are really constricted and fearful and like afraid of their own shadow, or then maybe self-harming if they're gonna hurt anyone.
She has an eating disorder.
And
very traumatic.
Yeah,
yeah. Mother was an alcoholic, very abusive to dad.
Very constricted, affectively constricted too.
Yeah. She's
yeah. Well, one of the things about attachment work that's kind of cool for someone who's simple-minded like I can be, which is that if you have someone who has a lot of acting out and affectively like dysregulated in this really wild way, the idea is to contain and bring down and bring in. And that's what I've talked about a lot today, right? If you have someone who regulates by down-regulating, by dissociating, by moving out of affect, by minimizing, by constricting, eating disorders are tricky this way,
yeah.
Because by controlling something in an environment that you don't feel much control in, right? Then the work is really about affect engaging and moving and expressive arts therapies and play and fun and painting and drawing and movement and ways in which less verbal necessarily expression is required, but more primary process. How old is she?
6 feet.
Yeah, she might not want to play in the dollhouse, but she might want to reorganize it or something. I don't know what I'm puppets or I don't know. These are kids who do better bringing affect in through playful, self-expressive. It's very interesting to me that a lot of the kids and children, adolescents with these stories, they don't know how to play at all. And if they play, it's this very compulsive, repetitive trauma play. And so for the younger kids where you're really needing to do play therapy, you're really needing to teach them how to play in the first place. If you have an adolescent that is this shut down and affectively constricted and cut off, the idea would really be, I mean, these kids don't have wonderful lives, you know, how to wonder, how to teach wonder and bring back in fun and music. I don't know. I mean,
I was wondering, what about music?
I mean, is anything you can do that is that brings affective expression and sensory stuff into her awareness in a safe, joyful way? These kids, they're so shut down, they're really scared of it feeling good. I mean, even more than your boy. You know, there's kids are really, more often girls than boys, but I've seen boys like this too. But the idea would be, how do you bring affect in and up? How do you safely pull it up so that someone who is pushing it out and disowning it makes room for it? And I, through identity work and persona work, sometimes she might have a playful part that she lost and get to know that part. You know, where's your little giggly girl? Did you ever have one of those? Never been one. Has, you know, Play-Doh or, I mean, I'm thinking out loud here, but a way to get her into finger paints or some kind of primary process where you take it all the way back, you know, see how far back you need to take it in terms of corrective play experience. You can say to her, you know, art therapists know all about this, so I'm out of my domain a little bit, but there are expressive arts, music, you know, and movement and that kind of thing that take it all the way back so that you're in this more primitive, unbounded place. And just getting in touch with that part of yourself that didn't get to play. And even to take care of that part of herself.
Her brother was the explosive kid that ended up in YDC and YDSU and became poorly.
Mm-hmm. It's the down regulator kid, especially, does she do okay in school?
Yeah, she's very quiet. She yeah. doesn't participate.
These are kids that in a way have a more adaptive, even though it's not whole child, they're not bringing their whole selves anywhere, especially with the eating disorder. She's diminishing herself even more through the eating disorder, so even less of her. But in a way, these kids get more from the environment than the acting out kids because she get people like a nice docile girl. Also, people take advantage of them, but they also, she's able possibly through some, I mean, some of this might be adaptive and useful too in terms of her down-regulated state. But the other thing is about depression, that some of these kids who are very down-regulated are just also very wicked depressed.
Yeah, she's
and so their whole activity level and sleep, and I'm, you know, that this, you know, the Bruce Perry stuff about early midbrain arousal and appetite. She's this is where interventions are. This is a kid who has appetite disorder and you know, regulates this kind of activity regulation, motor regulation, arousal stuff. So it'd be interesting to figure out what interventions are that he talks about in the article that I even gave you, but there's a lot more online that really approach the trauma place at the place that it's being expressed. Okay, I want to keep. So psychoeducation, telling them, normalizing things, very big, important part of all the work that we're doing. And the psychoeducation is for the adolescents and for the caregivers. This is what the trauma brain is like. This is what it means to trust, to learn to trust, to not learn to trust. Big point, intervention at the developmental level, not the chronological age. Big point. I'm explaining to families, to schools, to caregivers, when we are thinking about how to help your child, this child, we are thinking about meeting him or her at her developmental level, not at her chronological age. The chronological age with these kids means very little. It's not that they can never catch up, although there are distortions and delays for a long, long time for many of these kids. They might not be all fully there, you know, because of what they missed early on, but they can come along. Helping people not to take it personally. You don't take it personally about the boy. You know, it's a tough thing with parents when they're it's up in their face. Talking about triggers. I'm not going to do that right now. Okay, we're going to talk about affect interventions. There are different levels of affect interventions. A series of these are the usual suspects that you have been taught 1,010 times, which are teaching self-soothing and breathing and talk self-talk and safe places in your mind, right? And right, it's a whole very big toolbox and constellation of soothing techniques that work well for some kids and some work well. It depends on the kids. Some kids work, again, if you're a very down-regulated kid, you may need different self-soothing things than if you're a high intensity, I need to ride my bike as fast as I can 5 times around the block kind of kid. And so people's temperaments and ways of coping dictate what soothes them and what they need. So not everyone likes to fly fish. I know, it's crazy. You know, that soothes me, but that might not soothe you. I don't know, not so much. So the question is, how do you figure out in the toolbox of the ordinary garden variety cognitive behavioral anxiety management skills which ones you want to bring on board or try to bring on board, practice in the room? I think the in vivo thing is really great. So instead of telling them to breathe, you breathe with them, right, for the mastery. Emotional education, there's so much out there now. I'm almost embarrassed. There's all these child therapy, you know, posters of feelings and feelings games and feelings naming. My favorite 2 or 3 things that I do with kids, exercise that I've really enjoyed doing. One is folding a piece of paper and having them draw what they think people see on the outside and how they really feel on the inside with colors and with whatever. So that they are interested, because a lot of times these kids look better and feel worse. Sometimes with behavioral management, you can shape up the behavior and they look better because they're behaving better, but their depression is worse. So they're disappearing even more. The part of them that was worth fighting for is starting to give up, maybe. Another thing I like to do there's always series, you guys probably know a lot of these, but things with color coding and keys where you have a circle or an outline of their body and they make up color codes so that black is angry and blue is happy and contented. And, you know, they come up with different colors matched with different feeling words and they color in their bodies showing where in their body they have those different feelings. Or on a circle, how much, or a heart, how much their heart feels those different things. I talked about this yesterday, but I'll show you because it is one of my favorite ones. One of the things developmentally that's very, very difficult for kids before the age of 12 and often traumatize kids well into adolescence is understanding that you can feel many things at once. That's very hard for people. We're kind of a must pick one kind of world that we live in. And I keep losing my chalk. And I know, I'm really kind of crazy with it. Yeah, it might be. But I have this piece now. So as I've said to you, in terms of affect naming, knowing if you have faces of, you know, different expressions, you can ask them to say how they feel today or have, you know, play different kinds of games around that. But one of the things I like to do is guess, you know. We're talking about a visit with their birth mother, making this up. And I don't remember what I said yesterday about this, so who knows if it'll be the same or different. But so talking about a visit with a birth mother, and as we're having the conversation, I'm hearing a lot of stuff. The kid is naming that they're really mad that they're going to miss something that they wanted to do this weekend. It seems that there's some anxiety, so I'm going to say a little bit scared about what it's going to feel like to see her. You haven't seen her in a while. Sad because you miss her. What would be one more thing you might feel about visiting your birth mother? Excited. Okay, yeah, cool. So I'm making this up, obviously, and if there's only two feelings in the room, you know, that you have been able to come up with the adolescent or for the adolescent, you just do it like a one by one here, you know? And so I get a bunch of paper clips or something, and I say to them this. It seems like you're feeling a lot of different ways right now, and it's a little confusing for me, and I really want to know how you feel about this. So I want you to dump paper clips in different sized piles on these different words. So if you're feeling a little bit sad and a lot mad, you would be dumping more paper clips on the mad. So we can see how you're doing with this visit thing and how complicated it is. And so they end up putting a lot on excited and a little on the mad, whatever, and a couple here and a couple there. And then you sit there and look at it, you go, oh, I understand. This is pretty complicated. You're really excited, but you're a little bit scared too, huh? And then they've done this and it's been named. And you never once said, how do you feel about that? But it's there and it's named. And also they can see, not only can I have more than one feeling about something at a time, but I can have whole multiple feelings at once. That's pretty cool, right? Have anybody else have a affect naming and knowing activity that they just love? I was working with a little boy who said he was mad all the time. He was always mad. Everything made him mad. He was always mad. And that's what he knows. And he's struggling all the time. And in the afternoon, we did an activity in the classroom with popsicle sticks making stuff. And there were these eight little incredibly emotionally handicapped boys just gluing sticks. And it was like this little humming moment, little hands-on, quiet, nobody going off. And the kid who's mad all the time is just putting sticks, you know, glue, and he's really concentrating stuff. And I made all the little boys stop, and I said, you know, sometimes you guys just notice when you're upset. Do you notice what it feels like in your bodies right now to feel a little better and to be having a nice time and focusing and stuff? Your bodies can feel like that too, you know? And I said quietly to the mad kid, I said, this is what it feels like too to be you, you know? You feel like this too. Because when you're in a mad state or a sad state, you think that's the only state there is. That's all there is to it. So when I'm doing these affect interventions, they're in micro moments in the room. I say to the adolescent, how are you feeling right now? Oh, you're at a 7. Oh, that's bad. What do we got to do to get you to a 6? Can I help you get to a 6? I'll breathe with you. I'll talk about something else. I'll tell you a joke. Because we want them to be able to see that they can upregulate and downregulate. Sometimes if someone's at a 4 and they're really doing well, I'll say, just for the sake of it, let's go to a 5. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm feeling good today. So, well, I want you to see that you can get yourself back down again. So I want to sit with you and show you that I can help you go up and back down again. That sometimes in here, if we talk about or do things that are upsetting to you, the world isn't going to end because we also know how to get you back down to a 4 again. So tell me something horrible. What can I do to really upset you? I'd like to upset you just enough to get you to a 5 or a 6. What do I got to do? Right? Yeah. Keep going. Okay, I'm at a 5 now. I've talked about a lot of this other stuff already. Is there anything else on here that people are excited about that I haven't? Yeah, that's the whole, that, you know, we therapists have this really pathetically misguided idea that therapy is the only way that people who are dysregulated can feel better. And therapy, it turns out, isn't for everyone. Can you believe it? And I've worked with kids over the years, in addition to therapy or instead of, that finds anxiety management and anxiety reduction in lots of other kinds of spheres and groups and experiences. So I worked with a kid who joined a therapeutic acting group, you know, where they called acting out, in fact, where they do improv and skits and stuff. And it was with a bunch of other very divergent, unusual kids run by this very charismatic, accepting guy who created this really divergent culture of thespians. And I would say that this very funny little socially awkward boy, traumatized boy, got much more out of that than he did out of just therapy. Anything you can come up with, you know, of an outlet, of an avenue. Healthy kids have things they feel good about, that they're interested in and passionate about even. That's one of the things that, one of the hallmarks of resilient kids, that they, you know, that's what this book is about. Everybody who's resilient has two things going for them. They have someone to be close to and something to be proud of. That's universal in the resilience literature. Everybody who's going to make it in this world has something they're proud of that they enjoy doing or could enjoy doing if they could do it, and somebody that cares about them. It's universal. There might be more than that, and there's other ingredients and stuff, but any resilient person who has been dealt a terrible hand and ended up playing it well had those things. Yep.
This just reminds me, before you spoke a little bit and hinted at, like, gang. You know, like, mm-hmm. there's a way in which the gang
yeah.
serves this purpose. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There is.
And so...
It's very compelling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, in the problem to me, I mean, there's obviously a lot of problems with the gang culture. Very, you know, you can die very easily in it. There's immediately one of the really bad things about it. However, in the absence of any of this other stuff we've been talking about every day, all day long, I mean, it seems pretty compelling to me. I get it. You know, you have no affiliation, no connection, no peer group, no future, no sense of belonging, nobody taking care of you. The world is a perilous, dangerous place anyway. So the level of threat or danger, if you're interested, and you know, there's a lot of indoctrination in gangs, so there's kids who might be reluctant at first that end up getting, that's one another, yet another problem of juvenile detention in jail. It's really hard to get out of those environments as an older adolescent without having been drafted.
Getting back to the meaning piece and the spiritual piece, those gang things are also true of religious cults.
And cults.
Very, you know, very
absolutely. Absolutely. And we're questers. Yeah, and we're questers, right? We really want to have meaning and belonging and purpose. We're genetically, evolutionarily wired to connect. And, you know, a charismatic leader or a compelling structure in the absence of any other is pretty compelling. Yeah.
That's one of the things that when I was working with primarily boys, I think the difficulty a lot of times is that, to me, a lot of the acting out was really where they're self esteem.
Yeah.
It's like, this is not okay. They're saying, this is not all right, instead of just crumbling up and being a compliant one.
Yeah. Well, I like the, I mean, I
convert that into something.
Yeah. This is what I say to acting out kids. That's why when the person asked about the more defeated kids, is like, yeah, these acting out kids, there's a lot more juice there. They're harder, but there's somebody in there worth fighting for.
Yeah, that thinks this.
And this is what I say to them. I say, I love your spirit. Let's work on your style. I love your spirit. Let's work on your style. And especially with girls, you know, I say, you know, nobody wants to send another shut up girl out into the world. It's the last thing I want to do. However, we have to do something with your voice so that people can hear what you're trying to say. So I'm going to help you speak on your own behalf and advocate for yourself and fight for yourself in a more effective way so you can get more of what you want and need out of your life and not be so lonely and in pain and suffer this way. Okay, so you have to fill those out. I'm going to keep going while you're thinking that. We've done number scales and feeling thermometers. Yeah. I do. Here's one from Amnesty International.
Thanks.
We've talked about up and down regulation, managing dissociation tendencies by helping them practice down regulating. I've talked about a lot of this stuff. People are really into Play-Doh balls. It's funny, over the years, someone always raises that. I added it in here. I don't even do it. But someone always says, do you do Play-Doh balls? And I'm like, so now I'll tell you about Play-Doh balls. Maybe you'll love it. Play-Doh balls, like making balls out of represented others or of feelings and doing stuff to them, pounding them down or, you know, mastery of this person makes me so mad, this is my madness and, you know, banging on it, or this person really takes good care of me and making a beautiful pink one. There's a lot of things people do with Play-Doh balls. There's a whole series of interventions that are very upsetting to me, which involve like throwing eggs against trees and or outlining perpetrators and throwing wet paper towels at them. And there's a lot. Beverly James has a lot of interventions that seem really cool and interesting, but I wouldn't ever do in a million years because they're so messy, among other things. I think you can get to it some other way. But there's a lot of expressive, affect-releasing kinds of interventions that involve enactments, symbolic enactment of affects and anger and sadness without actually hurting yourself or somebody else. That would be the thing. Now, did people want to know? We've done all this anyway. Land lease prefund, we've done all this. This is a bad executive, okay. Persona work, story of me. How do you learn to self-reflect? How do you learn to have a story of yourself that you can then step outside of yourself and look at? And we've talked a lot of ways about coherent narrative in terms of identity narratives. We're not going to do this exercise right now, but I'm going to show you how it's done. And you can take it home with you and try it, or you can do it with patients and clients on Monday. I'm interested in this idea of multiplicity and complexity, that obviously if you're working with someone who's pretty far down the DID road, you would do this pretty carefully, if at all. But most of us, even complexly traumatized us, are integrated enough, even if we use dissociation, so that we have an idea, there's this idea that we have a core self, someone who is home, some of the time anyway, who is us, and then many personas or parts, or this idea of multiplicity, ourselves, is very appealing to me. And it is also very appealing to adolescents who wake up feeling like somebody different in the morning. So I'm going to semi-leave you with this because I'm seeing the time here, but I have a couple other things that people want to do. So I'll just the idea is to build the complexity in. Instead of this idea of me, not me, or this idea of parts of us, trauma parts that need to be exiled. I work in the whole child, whole girl, whole boy way, which is I want everybody at the table. I want to know all of you. And I accept all of you, even the parts of you that are shameful. And I think anger management is hilarious because how about anger knowing and anger integrating and anger connecting? Because if you manage it, it's kind of a saying that you're disowning it, you know, like it needs to be managed, as opposed that it needs to be noticed and appreciated. And I'm speaking as an anxious person, so there was a lot of time in my life where I thought that I needed to manage my anxiety. Have you ever tried to manage your anxiety? It's amazing. And anger or any strong affects, manage your depression? Oh my God, what's more depressing than that? Really, seriously. So I thought, okay, let's how do we rework this so that there is an embracing and knowing? And you know, the Buddhists talk about this as acceptance, right? Non-judgment. That when anxiety visits me, I say, "Hello, anxiety. What are you doing here? You've come. I haven't really asked for you to be here. It seems like you think you need to be here for something." This is very interesting to me. It's interesting for someone who reacts with anger to have a relationship with their anger. A lot of these kids, they're really surviving, man. It's amazing that they have that kind of energy to protect themselves and take care of themselves. So in terms of, so you put your initial or your name, because there's a core self. And I like this. Richard Schwartz talks about internal family systems. And he talks about a core self too. And he talks about an exile or exiles, that we all have parts of us that we wish we didn't have, that I would like to have done once an anxiety-ectomy. My life would be much fuller without the, but you know what? It turns out not, because anxiety is part of my identity. It functions. It keeps me from the woolly mammoths. I mean, evolutionarily speaking, I don't know. So what happens if instead of exiling it, I tell you about it? I say, yeah, there's a part of me that's anxious. And when she's around, I'm judgmental and critical and ruminative and whatever. There's a part of me that fly fishes. I've mentioned that a few times. And when she's around, she is peaceful and tranquil and in a kind of trance, and time goes by. And there she just feels connected to, you know, all one, like Dr. Broner's soap, you know, connected with nature and everything. I'm a mom, I'm a teacher, I'm a daughter, you know, what a friend. And these parts of me, I'm a therapist, and these parts of me are me. I'm 54 years old. It's taken me a really long time to figure that out. So that when I am bringing my best therapist self to my work, it's still me. They don't get anxious me as much, or fisherman me particularly, but the therapist me is present usually and engaged and empathic, and I know when she's there. She's pretty good, you know, most of the time. Families say they want to take me home with them. I say, I want to take me home with me too, because the me that you have is not the me my kids are getting at the end of the day, right? Right? And isn't that the truth?
But your kids told you they don't want that voice.
Yeah, right. That's right. But they don't want therapist me. But what they would like, mom me, who has some anxious qualities, but also has some more fun and friendly and, you know, anyway, you get the idea. So take notes about this and try it on yourself, but also think about how you would apply it to identity work and identity narratives with adolescents. Because one of the things that it's been really fun with this, you do it pretty early on, and they get it right away because they feel like lots. I mean, and it's still them. You're not saying you're a multiple. You're saying there you are, but we all are complicated and have parts. And then you've done some of this, and they come in the next week, and they're really, really upset because somebody's done something mean to a friend. And you're like, you know, I don't remember meeting this part of you before. I'm really interested in getting to know her. Tell me about her. Well, it turns out you have a part of you that is really an advocate and into social justice. And then you can say down the line when she's berating herself or being upset about something, you know that advocate part of yourself that we talked about a few weeks ago? If you had access to her, what would she be saying right now? Because part of the thing is that we possess, and I like this, it sounds kind of woo-woo Brattleboro anyway, but it's the end of the day, that we possess within ourselves our capacities for healing if we don't exile parts of ourselves, right? That with the help of relationship and all this other stuff that we're doing, it is also true that people survive amazing, unfathomable pain and loss and abandonment and hurt. How do they do it? They're not doing it because, you know, we're seeing them 1 hour a week. They do it because there is something within men. I mean, some people are defeated by it. It's not like everybody. But an amazing number of kids survive this. And part of the reason they do it, I think, is recognizable here, is that we do possess within us ways of knowing what we need. And part of the good therapy, the healing therapy, is really helping clients access that for themselves, that we're not giving them what they need. They're actually getting access to it. So does this make sense at all? Okay. I'm not going to do much. We've done a lot of this. JNDs is just noticeable difference. We talked about that. How to hold vision of the future. Have I talked about holding hope today at all? I usually do. I'm going to end with that. How about that? I'm going to talk about hope. Islands of competence, we talked about that. Okay, we've done a lot of this. Oh, we did all this. I'm so proud. More people, more relationships. Okay. Joy and humor and playfulness. Spirit. SOS is a nice thing. That's just a little system to calm it down again. I say this to do this more with parents. Parents are starting to get into reactive place, and I've taught them this SOS thing, and we just go through it, which is really, let's stop the action here and just bring us all back into the room and calm. Again, wise mind. Okay. This is where I want to talk about hope and optimism. One of the reasons I love working with adolescents and people in crisis and transition is that this is a ripe opportunity where the brain is undergoing profound changes and experience and life is ahead of them and a lot can happen. And I think that I hold hope or cautious optimism because I really understand now that the thing that we are doing is healing and that it takes a long time to get an adolescent into the level of disarray and distress that we see. So the glue of connection and meaning making and competence and all the stuff we've talked about all day, it takes a while, right? It's not going to happen right away. But over time, the glue sets and things cohere. Identity coheres and relationship coheres. And I think that one of the really exciting places that I go with this is that Bruno Bettelheim idea. He was in a concentration camp, which is probably as traumatic as anything. And he said, we all survive on trust and hope. It's not the facts of our lives. It's this idea of hopefulness. And I say to adolescents and families in this very explicit way, I think I can help you. If I do, I mean, and if I don't, it shows up in some, it's resonant, you know, and growthful for us. If we're with a client that's like, oh, but, yeah. And we all have had those. I've had many, so I'm not holding myself up as some other example, except for as a human being just like you, really trying to do the best I can under very adverse circumstances. But knowing that for relationships to move forward, somebody in the room has to be hopeful. And I say this, I say, I know you're feeling despair, and I understand why. And you know, it's hard. What you're going through is nigh unto impossible. I can't imagine how hard it is. I get that. But I'm actually hopeful that it's not always going to feel this way, that you have a big, long life ahead of you, and I can help you feel better. And until you're hopeful yourself, I'm going to hold the hope for both of us. And it's a very powerful intervention, in a way, with families particularly, where parents come in and they're terrified and angry and feeling blamed. And I say, I got the other end of the rope. I'm going to help you do this. I'm hopeful. I don't think this is a train wreck. If I do think it's a train wreck and I can't help, I figure something else out. Send the keys to you. You like those. You know, or somebody, right? I mean, you figure it's supervision or you talk to a colleague or you refer the case or you build up the team in a way that makes you feel supported also. But it is childish of us to underestimate who we are or could be in the life of these kids. And we think that it's about technique or if I could just learn to do one more thing, then I'm going to, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. No, pay all the attention to the man or woman behind the curtain because it's us. It's the specificity of the attachment relationship to us that is transformative of the brains and hearts of these adolescents and families. And so my mirror to you is that you're heroes because you're willing to put your adoring eyes, your loving gaze, your caring presence, your intentional practice to help people who can't do it for themselves. So thank you.
Thank you.